From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The John Wayne you think of when you hear the name John Wayne was an icon, a persona. Part of it was real, but some of it came from the man himself. The writer Scott Eyman says Wayne built this icon brick by brick, and for some, it became the country's alter ego. In the movies, John Wayne almost always played a certain type. Warriors, men who settled the West or fought for democracy in the Pacific. Eyman says all of these characters had a taste for the fulfillment of an American imperative. Today in the program, we're talking about John Wayne. Eyman has written an extensive biography. He'll be with us today. We'll also talk about the role that Utah played in the John Wayne persona. That landscape was as iconic as the man himself. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you met John Wayne, the first thing you would probably notice was his size. He was big, really tall, massive hands. But the writer Scott Eyman, who met him in the 1970s, says there was also something delicate about the man that you wouldn't expect. He could be gracious and subdued. Apparently, he was a killer chess player, and he liked to talk about the game and art and the native cultures he studied. And that part doesn't seem to match the persona of John Wayne, the uber patriot, the right winger, the character he embodied in his films. Scott Eyman says John Wayne constructed this persona, but that line between the private man and the public image is extremely narrow. Today in the program, Scott Eyman is joining us to talk about his book about John Wayne, the biography called John Wayne, The Life and Legend. We're also going to talk about the part Utah played in the John Wayne story. The Utah film historian James Dark will be joining us a little bit later on the program. Scott Eyman is a film historian. Besides the latest book, he's also written biographies on John Ford and Cecil B. DeMille and several others. He's joining us today from a studio in North Palm Beach, Florida. And Scott Eyman, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, I know you've told this story a number of times, but I want to have you tell it again. And this is, of course, I wanted to start with you meeting John Wayne. This was in the summer of 1972, as you tell it in the book. You weren't very old. You were just you were 21 years old, I think it was.
I was 21 years old with barely a credential.
Right.
I'd published, you know, four or five pieces about the movies, but nothing that would have drawn anybody's interest, sometimes barely even my own. But I wanted to write about the movies seriously, so I decided I better start talking to people who made movies who interested me. So I thought I'd start with the older generation who were working less, so would be more able to, you know, talk to me.
Right.
So I wrote a batch of letters to people like Jean Renoir, William Wellman, William Clothier, John Wayne. And John Wayne's secretary wrote me back and said, well, if you're out here, I'll do my best to hook you two up. And I, well, that was good enough for me.
Yeah.
So 6 or 7 weeks later, I arrived in Los Angeles for the first time. I was living in Ohio at the time. Dialed the secretary. She said, well, he's shooting a TV show at CBS. If you go there Thursday afternoon, he'll talk to you.
Wow.
So there I was.
Yeah.
And I knocked on the door, and there he was, big as a wall. Hands the size of home plate. As I write in the book, if a normal-sized man could have stood behind him and not be seen.
Right.
And he was I was surprised. He was smoking a little black cigar.
Mm.
And I was surprised because at that point, John Wayne was America's most famous cancer survivor.
Yeah.
But
he only had one lung. Yeah.
He had lost a lung to cancer at the end of 1963, and this was 1972.
Mm.
So 9 years later, he's puffing away contentedly on a little black cigar. What I didn't know at the time was that he really was addicted.
Yeah.
and couldn't stop. I mean, he was always – sometimes he would chew tobacco. Sometimes he would sneak some cigarettes. Sometimes he'd smoke a cigar. But he always had to have some kind of nicotine going on.
I wanted to get this point in because I think this was interesting as the setup to this conversation. You mentioned and obviously you were conscious about this because, of course, he's sort of this notorious traditionalist right winger. And you say that your hair was probably longer than he liked, but he didn't seem to altogether mind. And I think what's so interesting is he really seemed to like your interview because you stayed away from two of the things that he just didn't seem to be that interested in talking about, at least not anymore at that point in his life. And that was cancer and politics. I guess he was kind of tired of that at that point.
He was a one-on-one guy. I didn't understand this at the time because I didn't have enough experience myself. But he was a one-on-one guy. He would, if you asked him a question about politics, he would rise to the occasion and start talking in generalities about general things.
Yeah.
But on a one-on-one basis, all that was tamped down and it kind of was put way, way in the background. I wanted to talk about the movies I'd already begun to admire and to study, the films he'd made with John Ford, the films he'd made with Henry Hathaway and William Wellman, and how he worked with Greg Toland, the cameraman on Long Voyage Home, as opposed to working with William Clothier, his in-house cameraman at Bat Jack. All these very specific filmmaking questions. And he loved that. And what I didn't understand at the time was that he was a journeyman film man, by which I mean everybody who works in the movies likes the money that the movies pay you, and everybody likes the fame that the movies give you, the good tables at restaurants, the people snapping your photos as you get out of the car at the premiere, and all that. Very few people actually like the process of making movies because it's not a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You act for half a minute, and then you wait for a half an hour while they shift the camera and shift the lights. It's very hard to maintain any kind of focus or concentration, which is why they pay you all that money. But what I didn't understand at the time and what I came to understand in talking to all the people I interviewed for the book was that he loved the process of making movies. He was that guy who would really rather be on a movie set than any place else. Mm. He liked joshing with the stuntman. He liked running lines with actors. He liked working with young actors and giving them tips about how to hold the camera. He liked getting there at 7 in the morning just at the same time the director did. And he liked leaving at 6:30 or 7. It was the times away when he wasn't on a movie set that life could be difficult and things happened that he couldn't control. But on a movie set, that was where he was, probably the happiest.
One thing you've written is that John Wayne understood that movies have wires into our subconscious. What do you mean by that? His sense of what movies did for the rest of us, what was his sense of that?
He was a movie-struck kid. Growing up in Glendale, he went to the movies constantly, and he ingested them whole. His favorite movie of that era was the Rex Ingram version of The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse with Rudolph Valentino. And even as late as 1972 or 3, when he was filling out one of these lists of the best movies I've ever seen that celebrities are asked to do, there were a couple John Ford movies on there. The Quiet Man was on the list, I remember. But the number one title was The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. He was a movie fan. He understood because that movie had affected him hugely as a young boy. He would have been 13 or 14 at the time he saw it. And he always carried it in his head and in his heart. So he understood from the point of view of the audience what power and impact a movie, just one single movie, can have on a human spirit. Mm. And he didn't take that responsibility lightly.
You tell the story about he at Winterset, Iowa, about 350 miles west of Chicago, 35 miles from Des Moines. It was this pleasant small town. He was, I guess technically you could say it was his hometown, but he wasn't there very long. Even though he later would tell these stories of riding horses there and playing football there, and he had this very particular story about getting shocked by static electricity. But you say those stories were I'm not sure if they were entirely made up, but it was impossible for him to have had that kind of experience there in Iowa.
No, I think he was conflating memories.
Yeah.
In the way that you do when you're a child and you think you were, 3 years old, but actually you were six.
Right.
And you think it was on the corner of the street where you live, but actually it was three blocks away. And if your mother is there or your brother or your father is there to correct you and say, no, that's not actually what happened. It's the Rashomon effect. Memory's tricky.
Yeah.
He was in Iowa for about 2 years, 3 years. And they moved around. They hopscotched around the heartland of America because his father all his life could not really make a living.
Right.
He was noticeably unsuccessful at almost everything he tried. So he was always – he was like a character in Paint Your Wagon or something. The gold strike was always going to be the next – over the next hill, over the next claim. And it never really came in. It came in for his son. It never came in for Clyde Morrison. And then they ended up in the desert in Palmdale, right. And that was a nightmare. And actually he did his flourishing, his growing up, where he really became – started to become – John Wayne, that happened in Glendale, California, right. Which is where they landed when he was about 12 years old. Well, and it that's where he really did his growing up.
Well, and this is where he – it seems like where the – I guess the question is when did he start to – as you put it in the book that he sort of built this persona, this icon of John Wayne brick by brick. And you have this quote in the book. It's kind of an epigraph where – this is from 1957 where John Wayne says this. He says, "That guy you see on the screen isn't really me. I never was and never will be a film personality like John Wayne." But he says, "But I know him well. I have to make a living out of him." So John Wayne was – I guess the question is, so how much – how deliberate was this idea of him constructing this persona that we all came to know as John Wayne?
As I said, he was a movie-struck kid. And he wanted to be an actor. Now, there were two problems with that ambition. On the one hand, he's a blue-collar kid with no money.
Right.
That's A. B, he's a jock. The only way he got into college was on a football scholarship into USC. Mm-hmm. He was a star lineman at Glendale High School, and he was a very fine athlete. He was good at almost everything he did. He was on the honor roll. He had a 93 or a 94 average. He was president of the senior class. He wrote for the school newspaper. I excerpt some of his articles he wrote.
Yeah.
He was a big man on campus, actually. So he was destined. He was driven. He was focused. He was going to be successful. It was a question of what he's going to be successful at. And he wanted to be an actor. But he's A, a blue-collar kid, and B, a jock. And if there's anything a blue-collar jock in the early part of the 20th century couldn't admit to, it's, I want to be an actor.
Yeah.
It's just not suitable occupation for a blue-collar jock. So he always wanted to give the impression that he backed into acting, that they, you know, that he, somebody tapped him on the shoulder and said, "You got a nice look, kid. Why don't you do a screen test?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "Sure." And just the dominoes started to fall, and it was just all a happy accident. It's a total fantasy. It wasn't a happy accident at all. When he was a kid at USC, he was pestering movie producers for jobs. Put me in this, put me in that. He got a summer job at the Fox studio because he needed money, because they were lower middle class on their best day, the Morrison family.
Right.
So he had some income. So he was propping at Fox, and he glommed onto John Ford, who was already a very successful director on the Fox lot, and kind of got himself adopted mm-hmm. by this guy. Even though he adored his father, he actually spent the better part of his young manhood in search of a father substitute. And what he was looking for was not someone who was like Clyde Morrison, who was a very nice guy who taught him how to play football, taught him how to shoot baskets, taught him how to do this and that. What he was looking for was someone who was successful, someone who could mentor him mm-hmm. in how to be a successful adult male, and which is what Ford did.
Yeah,
because Ford had his demons, God knows. But Ford was in total control on a film set and did what he wanted, and people just got out of his way. They were all little – everybody was scared of him, even people who made more money than he did and who were his supposed superiors within the studio hierarchy. Nobody messed with Jack Ford because he was scary. And Wayne was attracted to that control that Ford had that his father did not have. As I said, he wanted to be an actor. One of the most interesting interviews I got on the book was with – an actor, Jimmy Lydon, who worked with Wayne on a production of What Price Glory in the late 40s. It was a benefit that Ford put on. And Oliver Hardy was also in the production, doing a stage bit, doing one scene bit in this production of What Price Glory. And Lydon told me how awestruck John Wayne was to be working with Oliver Hardy. And he would just sit at Hardy's feet as they traveled around California doing these shows, doing the production. While Hardy told tales about how Laurel and Hardy were put together and doing this and doing that. And Lydon realized that John Wayne was a movie-struck kid. He was already a huge – she was the number one box office star. This is 1949. Red River's come out. She Wore Yellow Ribbons come out. Stagecoach has come out. He's a huge star. And he's just sitting with, you know, his jaw open listening to Oliver Hardy tell stories. And Lydon didn't think people understood that about him. And frankly, until Lydon told me, I didn't understand that about him.
Yeah. You mentioned in you know, the question comes up, would there have been – let me ask you this. Would there have been a John Wayne if there hadn't been a John Ford?
That's a profound question. That's going into alternate history.
Yeah.
What if the Confederacy had won the Civil War?
Right, right.
My gut is he was a medium successful cowboy star when John Wayne tapped him on the shoulder and said, you're going to do Stagecoach for me, kid.
Yeah.
And then things started happening in a big way as opposed to a small way. Now, there's a limit as to how far you can be, how old you can be and be a successful star of B-Westerns. He had a few years to go yet before he just got too old. If it hadn't happened, if he hadn't done Stagecoach, I suspect he would have backed off of acting and gone into production. He was not going to leave the movie business. Right. That wasn't going to happen. He loved the movie business. I suspect he could have gone into production and been quite successful, as he later turned out to be with Bat Jack Productions, which made a lot of very successful John Wayne movies and a lot of very good movies with other people as well, like Seven Men from Now for Randolph Scott, directed by Bud Bedeker, and Bedeker's The Bullfighter and The Lady. Wayne had a pretty good eye for good scripts for other people. And he made some good movies outside of John Wayne movies. So I suspect if Ford had never tapped him on the shoulder and he'd never made Stagecoach and he hadn't gotten Red River, that he would have segued into producing films and been quite successful.
Yeah. You begin the book with this story of this iconic moment, really, in the film Stagecoach. This was, of course, as you mentioned, the John Ford film. And I think most people listening right now are going to remember the scene. It's the first time we see John Wayne in the picture. He plays the Ringo Kid, of course. And the first time we see him, he spins his Winchester rifle, cocking it in one hand, which, as you tell in the book, takes a bit of doing. I really like this story because this image is such an important part of the way John Wayne becomes John Wayne, the way John Ford thinks of this character. Tell this little story about this little piece of stage business that was so important.
Well, Ford wanted to introduce Wayne in the picture with a real flourish. He wanted to let the audience know that this kid was something special. So he did something he rarely did. It's a very rapid track in into from a medium shot, basically a full figure shot. The camera rushes in into a full face close up of Wayne as the Ringo Kid. And this is very atypical for Ford. Spielberg basically appropriated this camera move and uses it all the time. He's used it for 25 years.
Right.
But in 1939, this was a very, very unusual camera movement because it's very abrupt. It's very liquid, and it makes the audience conscious of the camera and the actor, and that was something they usually didn't do. So as he often did, Ford said, "Okay, I want you to do something with a gun. You work it out." He would often give actors these problems and force them to be creative. And he's supposed to be carrying a saddle, and he's supposed to be handling a rifle, and the saddle was obviously a problem. And there's also supposed to be a horse in the shot.
Yeah.
Well, this is way too many props for for this shot. It's too cluttered. So Ford gets rid of the horse, and then Wayne is standing there with a saddle in one hand and the rifle in the other, and he's thinking, "What am I going to do? I can't drop the rifle and do a fast draw with my gun because every cowboy in the movies can do a fast draw with a pistol and twirl it. That's hack. It's cliche. That's not impressive." So what I've got to do something with the rifle. What am I going to do with the rifle? Okay. Then he's Yakima Canutt, the great stuntman, who is the stunt coordinator on Stagecoach and an old friend of Wayne's for 10 years at this point. They'd worked together in dozens and dozens of B-Westerns at Monogram and Republic. And Yakima Canutt mentioned that when he was a boy, he'd seen the Buffalo Bill Wild West show. And it had a scene where the Indians are attacking, you know, the fort. And the cavalry comes to the rescue, and they're led by a scout who, with one hand, cocks his rifle in midair while riding to the rescue. And the crowd went nuts. And he said, but I've never seen anybody else do the move. And Wayne thought, well, let's see how what do you have to do that move, to cock a rifle in midair with one hand. So we went to the prop department, and the prop department said, well, we'll have to give you a loop ring. They have to take off the ring. It's an 1892 Winchester, standard Winchester rifle. So they took off the conventional ring and put on a loop ring, which gives the hand room to maneuver.
Yeah.
So he tried the maneuver, but the rifle was too long. It kept getting stuck in his armpit. His arms weren't quite long enough for the rifle to pass beneath his arm. So what do you do then? So then they took it back to props, and they sawed an inch and a half off the end of the rifle. And then they soldered the sight back on the end of the rifle barrel. So it looked right. And then he tried the move again, and it worked. The gun was now short enough for him to do the move. And he rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed so it would look smooth. So when you see that shot the next time you see Stagecoach, nobody's ever looked at the rifle. They're looking at that face and the they're noticing the cameras. It swoops into the full close-up of Wayne. But if you stop and look at the rifle, it's a little bit short.
Right.
But these are the kinds of things you have to do in the movies. It has to look effortless, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of stop and start. That one shot probably took, between all the trips back and forth to the prop department, between Wayne and Canute coming up with the move and then showing it to Ford and Ford approving and all the back and forth and holding the focus on the shot, it probably took 5 days to get that, what, a 10-second shot in the film. But that's not atypical for a shot that just moves like, you know, water over rock in a riverbed. It's a beautiful shot, but it was not easily achieved.
And you say it wasn't just a shot. It was. I think this is how you put it in the book. An enunciation mm-hmm. of a movie star. John, mm-hmm. as you said before, John Ford wanted to show to people this was not just an ordinary actor. We've got something special here, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. If he just introduced him with a close-up, or if he just walked into the shot, you know. A convenient way to show it, because it's not a big-budget picture. It's a very modestly budgeted picture. The Stagecoach pulls up. There's a shot off screen, and then you see Wayne, and the camera swoops into the close-up. If Ford had been less attentive to things like details, he would have just had a medium shot of Wayne cocking the rifle. It would have been a lot quicker, a lot less grief. But it had to be right, because part of the problem was that Wayne was basically damaged goods in 1939. He'd been heralded as a star in The Big Trail in 1930, this big widescreen spectacular, and the film had failed. It had been a huge financial disaster. And after that, Wayne had to take what he could get. So he was regarded as damaged goods by the industry at large and by those portions of the audience that hadn't seen him. The audience for B-Westerns was largely rural, largely small town, and Wayne was not a big star in 1939 in New York. He was not a star in Los Angeles. He was a star in all those medium-sized and small-sized towns that played the B-Westerns that Republic and Monogram made. And those people loved him, and they would follow him anywhere. And as a matter of fact, they followed him for the next 35 or 40 years. But in New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, Wayne was regarded as a failed movie star of 1930. So what Ford had to do was overcome that resistance and say, this kid is special, and I'm going to show you how special he is. I'm going to introduce him in a very special way.
Scott Eyman is with us. He's author of the book John Wayne, The Life and Legend. We are going to take a brief break. We're going to talk about the role that Utah played in the icon that became John Wayne. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUEI.
Hold it!
Whoa, steady. Ho, ho.
Hey, look, it's Ringo.
Yeah. Hello, kid.
Hello, Curly. Hiya, Buck. How's your folks?
Oh, just fine, Ringo, except my grandfather came
up. Shut up. Didn't expect to see you riding shotgun on this run, Marshal.
Going to Lordsburg? I figured you'd be there by this time.
No. Lame horse. Well, it looks like you've got another passenger.
Yeah. I'll take the Winchester.
You may need me in this Winchester, Curly. Saw a ranch house burning last night.
You don't understand, kid. You're under arrest.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about John Wayne. Scott Eyman has written an exhaustive biography of the film star who created an all-American persona for himself. The Utah film historian James Dark is going to join us as well, because when you're talking about John Wayne films, you're often talking about settings here in Utah. Scott Eyman is the author of the book, again, John Wayne, The Life and Legend, and James Dark is joining us, curator of BYU's Motion Picture Archive and the L. Tom Perry Special Collections at the Brigham Young University Library. We should also mention the archive is home to the Scott Eyman papers. That's a collection of Eyman's research. Did you know you had papers, Scott Eyman? Scott Eyman papers.
It has become appallingly apparent to me that I do indeed have
papers. Yes, you do.
Which my dog does not, I might
add. James Dark is the author of When Hollywood Came to Town, History of Movie Making in Utah. And Professor James Dark, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on the air with you and with my good friend Scott. You mentioned, Doug, that it's an exhaustive biography, but it is not exhausting. Scott and I have been friends for almost a quarter of a century, and what drew me to him was the almost singularly unique way that he goes after the nut of the story. Not legend, not folklore, but he goes for primary source materials, getting to the bottom of the story, and that's why I think this biography puts him to the front of the line of those who have written about John Wayne. And I appreciated it as well, because my connection with the John Wayne story is not only knowing Scott and the work that he does and having done a history of movie making in Utah, but I was born and raised in Glendale, California.
Wow.
And went to the same high school that he did, although not at the same time. My mother also went to Glendale High School, so we not only lived with the aura of John Wayne in the movies that we all watched, I went to where he went to school, and you heard stories, and it was always identified, this is Glendale High School, is the high school where John Wayne went to high school.
Well, I want to start with Stagecoach, because I think this is one of the first times, at least in a John Ford film, that we see that iconic Monument Valley on the Arizona-Utah border. And James Dark, I wanted you to start with that. Of course, that symbol for the American West. How did John Ford learn about Monument Valley?
Well, as Robert Browning would say, let me count the ways. There are so many stories of how this happened, and I'll let Scott handle most of them. But according to Wayne's account in Maurice Zolotow's biography, John Wayne was working on a George O'Brien picture as a prop man. And the only one that I can come to is the Lone Star Ranger that was released in 1930 and filmed in Monument Valley. John Wayne claims to have told the old man, as he called Ford, about Monument Valley. And Ford, in his characteristic way, appropriated his finding, that is, Ford's finding Monument Valley, and announcing to the crew that this beautiful place that he had discovered was where they were going to go to make the film. And Scott, you want to deal with the others?
Well, you know, it's not mutually exclusive. I mean, Wayne's story could, in fact, be the case. I don't think Ford went there in 1930. In 1938, a guy named Harry Goulding, who had a trading post in Monument Valley, heard that they were going to be making a Western in Kayenta. And he thought, well, why are they going to Kayenta? Monument Valley is much more beautiful. And he had a brother-in-law in Los Angeles, and he found out that the film was going to be made by Walter Wanger Productions. So he got a group of photographs together, professional photographs taken by Joseph Munch, who'd spent decades working for Arizona Highways magazine, shooting picturesque images of Arizona. And he got a group of Munch's black and white photographs together and drove to Los Angeles, where he found Walter Wanger Productions, and just basically walked through the door and said, I'd like to see the director of this Western movie you're supposed to be making in Kayenta. And Ford happened to be there, so he went in to see Ford, and Ford looked at the photos and said, I've been looking for a place like this all my life. So the story about Wayne telling him about Monument Valley in 1930 and the story about Harry Goulding showing up at Walter Wanger Productions in 1938 could possibly join together. I'm sure it's one or the other or some combination of both.
Yeah. James,
they're all great stories.
Yeah, there's speaking of great stories, there's a great story you tell in your book about during the shooting. I think this was of Stagecoach, where Harry Goulding, which Scott Eyman mentioned, he hired this Navajo medicine man to help, as I get this story right, assure that they had clouds and scenic weather for the film.
Well, yes, the local Navajo medicine man gave a blessing on this production, that they would have the kind of weather that they would need. And weather was a concern because you'll notice in a couple of the shots, long shots, where the wagon is going across the sandstone valley floor, you can see traces of snow. And this is of great concern to a film company who's making this film on what Scott rightly describes as a modest budget. You can't take many more days than you've budgeted for, especially when you're literally out in the middle of nowhere. And the weather cooperated.
I want to talk about some of the films that were shot in Utah. Let's talk about Fort Apache. And James Dark, start us out here, because this is, I guess this is the first of the series of films. They've been called the John Ford Cavalry Trilogy, and they all involve, of course, John Wayne. But Fort Apache is the first one of those. This was in 1948?
Yes. The filming occurred in 1947, and it's a thinly veiled story about the arrogant George Custer, with a character played by Henry Fonda as Owen Thursday. And John Wayne is a subordinate to Thursday when he comes onto the military base and has to obey orders that cause him to grind his teeth because he knows Indians much more than this cavalry commander who has come out from the East. And there's a suggestion that the Henry Fonda character as commander is being punished for this duty in the West, and he just as soon not be here, so why not wipe out the Indians? The film turned out to be a tremendous success, and it was the first of, as you noted, three films that were known as the trilogy, Fort Apache, Rio Grande, and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
Yeah. What was the connection for John Ford of did he have a theme in mind, Scott Eyman, for did he conceive of it as a trilogy, or did he just keep coming back to a beautiful setting when he found a good story?
Well, they were made I think partially for commercial reasons. After the war, Ford had had a very interesting war working attached to the OSS, and he'd come back and he'd started up an independent corporation called Argosy to make John Ford movies. And their first production was a utter disaster called The Fugitive, which was an adaptation of Graham Greene's novel The Power and the Glory, which is about a whiskey priest. Well, given the censorship of the time and given Ford's own ardent Catholicism, you really couldn't do Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory. So he made it into something else, and in any case, nobody wanted to see it. So Argosy Productions started off with 2.5 strikes against it. And in order to keep the operation alive, Ford turned to what he knew he could do very well indeed, which is make excellent westerns at a modest price with John Wayne, which was virtually a guarantee of success. So that was the underlying motive behind Fort Apache and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Rio Grande was also part of a make good in that Ford had moved his operation to Republic Pictures in order to do his dream project, The Quiet Man.
Yeah.
Herbert Yates, who ran Republic, said he would do The Quiet Man in Technicolor and let Ford shoot it in Ireland if Ford did a Western with John Wayne first, because Yates was convinced that The Quiet Man was going to be a disaster. And the only way to not lose money on this particular deal was to have a John Wayne Western to basically balance out this artistic flop that John Ford was determined to make. So the Cavalry trilogy, in essence, was a commercial accommodation to Ford's deep dish drama that failed.
Let's talk about The Searchers, which a lot of people regard this as, if not the, certainly one of John Ford's masterpieces. This came out in 1956, I think it was.
Correct.
You mentioned it's regarded as, if I'm not sure where it stands in terms of its sort of qualitative brilliance, but you mentioned it's certainly John Ford's most beautiful Western.
Well, and yes, and has been the holy grail for a number of filmmakers. Spielberg mentions that he has to see it every year. And many film students and filmmakers worship at the Shrine of the Searchers. But it was totally ignored for Academy Award nominations in 1956, which maybe tells you more about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences than it does about the Searchers. Photographed in a proprietary process called VistaVision, razor sharp in Technicolor, and shows off Monument Valley in a way that it had never been shown off before. And by this time, Ford pretty much considered Monument Valley, as well as other filmmakers, as John Ford's personal property. He made more films there than anyone else, even though a couple had tried before that time. It had always been identified as Ford's personal property. But it's a beautiful film, yet at the same time a very disturbing and tragic film.
Yeah.
Because the performance of John Wayne as this expatriate Confederate soldier coming back after the Civil War is one of intense racial hatred against the Indians. And he and the Indian chief that he is against, named Scar, are really two sides of the same coin. And that's what makes the film so fascinating and yet in other ways so horrifying and yet physically, stunningly beautiful film.
Scott Eyman, you think that this may be one of his greatest performances, John Wayne's in The Searchers?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I don't think there's any doubt about it. That and Red River. Red River was a crucial picture made for Howard Hawks. Red River was a crucial picture because up until Red River, Ford had always used Wayne basically as a very calm, centered, focused man of the earth, a man comfortable with himself and comfortable in his environment. And then Hawks hires Wayne to play this Old Testament angry, ferocious, unfair, savage patriarchal character. Mm-hmm. And it's the missing arrow in Wayne's acting quiver. And he took to it beautifully, and he played it 100%. And for the rest of his career, it basically gave him the key for the rest of his career. He could alternate between this passive, gentle John Wayne, or he could be the savage, authoritarian John Wayne that he is in The Searchers. Mm-hmm. Or in some pictures, he could combine those two strains. But it gave him it just gave him a huge amount of adaptability that he hadn't had before. And it's a tribute to his willingness to go very far out of his own comfort zone. Mm-hmm. If John Wayne had been producing either The Searchers or Red River, I don't think he would have played those parts. I think he would have asked some other actor to play those parts.
Wow.
Because I don't think he was willing to go further if Pappy Ford was pushing him or if Howard Hawks was pushing him. Left to his own devices, he tended to make what a friend of mine calls comfort westerns. John Wayne, as he knew the public wanted to see him. The Searchers and Red River give the public a John Wayne they'd never seen before and weren't actually sure they were going to like. But John Ford didn't care, and Howard Hawks didn't care. They were out to make the movie they wanted to make,
and
Wayne was willing to go along with them.
There's a wonderful letter in the Howard Hawks papers that we have at Brigham Young University that underscores what Scott has described wonderfully in his book as the mentoring role of John Ford to John Wayne. And it's a letter from Ford to Hawks after he hired him for Red River saying, "Take care of Duke." Hmm. Just like a father to someone who's going over to sleep overnight at somebody else's house. You just look out for him. Take care of him.
Well,
it's a wonderful letter.
Yeah. There's a question that comes from Ryan there in Orem. He said, I wonder if you'd be willing to discuss John Wayne's desire for a surrogate father. Ryan writes, I've been struck for some time by the dominance of this theme in John Wayne's films, and I wonder if you think that John Wayne's personal search for a father figure influenced his selection of films in which he played that surrogate role himself. For example, Ryan mentions Red River and Hondo and The Cowboys, certainly The Shootist as well. Scott Eyman, you start. What do you think?
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. I think there's a lot to it. Wayne was drawn, as I said, Wayne's father was a loving father. He was emotionally available, but he couldn't support his family. He couldn't put food on the table, which is, after all, the primary requisite of a father. You're supposed to be able to, you know, send your kids to school, feed them, clothe them, get them an education, and this Clyde Morrison was unable to do. So Wayne was drawn to, in a funny sort of reversal, emotionally unavailable men who were extraordinarily competent and able to do anything they set their minds to do. Before he met John Ford, he met a guy named Howard Jones, who was the football coach at USC and a great coach, the rough equivalent of Newt Rockne, except Howard Jones died young. Well, so did Newt Rockne, but never mind. And Howard Jones was the kind of guy that if you ran for 250 yards, blocked everybody who got near you, played equivalently great defense as they did in those days. They played both ways. He'd give you a curt nod. That was all you were going to get. He was the opposite of the effusive coach who hugs and, you know, pats his guys on the backside and tells them they can come to him at any time of the day or night for any advice. No, he was more like Lee Ermey in Full Metal Jacket. He was not emotionally available. And for some reason, because I think his own father had been a failure but emotionally available, he gravitated towards men like Howard Jones and a year or two later, John Ford, who were – and Ford is such a complex character. I mean, I spent 650 pages writing about John Ford and 6 years of my life, and I don't think I plumbed the depths, frankly. I think I could do another 500 pages on John Ford, but I'm not going to. But Ford – was the father figure that Wayne chose. He was the father figure that came through for Wayne in a way that Wayne's own father hadn't. He gave Wayne his impetus. He gave Wayne his craft. He demanded more of Wayne than Wayne ever demanded of himself, frankly. And in return, Wayne gave Ford his unyielding loyalty. Ford abused him. Ford was derogatory towards Wayne in front of other people on a film set on a regular basis, and Wayne took it. He never questioned him. He never came back at him. He never said, get off my back. He just took it because it was all worth it to Wayne, and because Ford had not only given him his identity, helped form his identity, he'd given him his career.
Scott Iman is with us. He's the author of the book John Wayne, The Life and Legend. We also have James Dark with us, who curates the Motion Picture Archive at Brigham Young University, their library there. He's the author of the book When Hollywood Came to Town. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about John Wayne. We have Scott Iman with us. He's the author of a biography called John Wayne, The Life and Legend, came out recently. We also have James Dark with us, who curates the Motion Picture Archive at the Brigham Young University Library, author of the book When Hollywood Came to Town. James Dark, I want to start with you on the question of The Conqueror, which was a film that came out in the mid-1950s, shot a good part of it anyway, and in Utah, near St. George, actually. The canyon's near St. George. Ivins, Utah, I think it was. Snow Canyon there. Say something about this film in the sense that it was incredibly expensive. It's come to be seen as, a lot of people anyway, as a joke, even though I think it did reasonably well at the box office. But it's an interesting story because it sort of brings up the question of the nuclear fallout, the tests that were going on, and the downwinders who were involved. Say something about The Conqueror.
Well, you know, if you could imagine a less likely role for John Wayne than Genghis Khan, I would defy anyone to make one up. And the fact that he backed this and then recommended actor Dick Powell to direct it. And when Dick Powell was asked, how could you direct such a film like this? And he said, well, if John Wayne and Howard Hughes really want to do it and they want you to do it, you don't turn down John Wayne. There's another aspect of his compelling force. But this 16th century historical saga was, as you said, all played out in near Ivins and in various valleys around St. George with, as we found out, radioactive soil from the 1953 tests at Yucca Flats in Nevada. Now, we didn't know that much on a public scale about the effects of radioactive fallout. But one of the sons of an individual who worked on the film that I interviewed in Kanab mentioned that his father, who worked as an electrician on the film, remembered talking at the end of some days that it was very, very cloudy, and yet the sun wasn't blazing on them, and yet their skin would turn red and it was terribly itchy. And they weren't sure what was going on here. Well, we later learned it was from the radioactive fallout. But this matter of those who contracted cancer who worked on the film, an extensive study done by People magazine of all sources, indicated that 90 out of the 220 crew members contracted cancer. 46 died from it, including Susan Hayward, Agnes Moorehead, Pedro Armendariz, who committed suicide in 1963 because of his cancer, Dick Powell, and John Wayne. But it's not conclusive because all of these were heavy cigarette smokers. And as Scott painfully documents in his book, so was John Wayne.
Yeah, yeah. Scott, I mean, what do you think about that question? Because it clearly comes up. You don't spend a lot of time on it. But what do you think?
I think it's possible that there was some contributing factor. I think a more probable cause is that John Wayne smoked 4 packs a day of unfiltered Camels for 40 years.
Right.
There are contributing factors to any health catastrophe. But certainly his extensive consumption of nicotine since he was a teenager, I think, was probably more of a cause for his cancer than anything else would have been. But if they were on location for what, 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks?
Yes.
Then they go
yes,
back to the studio.
5 to 6 weeks.
So is 5 or 6 weeks sufficient? Does 5 or 6 weeks add to the tar and nicotine he would have ingested? Would it have been enough to give cancer to someone who'd never smoked? I don't know. You'd have to ask oncology professionals. If less than half of the people who worked in the picture contracted cancer, it seems to me there's a big question mark there.
And Patrick Wayne, as I quote in my book, discounted the Conqueror shoot as a contributing cause. And Dick Hammer, who was a St. George restaurateur who catered the meals on location and was a lifelong resident of the area, didn't contract cancer. And at the time, he discounted that as a critical factor of those getting cancer.
We don't have time to take this call, but let me just – OC is calling from Ogden, and he talks about the time that he said he was a retired camera person, had covered John Wayne as a cameraman, said that every time he dealt with him, he was kind of terrible, was drunk at times, difficult to deal with. Does this sound familiar? What was it like? I mean, his general personality, I mean, he could be lovely to people, but I guess he could also be difficult, I suppose. Scott Iman?
I didn't come into a lot of that when talking to the people. I mean, I did over 100 interviews. I talked to everybody I could find above ground, basically. And from actors to crew to assistant directors to cameramen to movie stars to directors and producers. And the overwhelming consensus was, as Walter Mirisch called me a couple of weeks ago, the producer, and said, congratulations, the book, blah, blah, blah. And we got to talking, and he said, I worked with hundreds of movie stars in my career. And he said, I can count on 2 hands the number of movie stars that were nice guys. He said, Duke Wayne was a nice guy. He treated people well that he didn't have to be nice to, in subsidiary people. Now, did he have bad days? I'm sure he had bad days. Did he drink? He drank. He didn't drink on the set, but he drank.
Right.
But he was a gregarious drunk. He wasn't a dark, abusive drunk. He tended to get even more cheerful when he drank. So it's possible that this gentleman, had some bad luck, or maybe he caught him at a bad period in his life. He did have a couple periods in his life where the walls were closing in on him, and he reacted as most people do when the walls close in on them.
Well, you mentioned James Dark in 1961, the Comancheros. He generally had a pretty good reputation among the locals in Utah when he came. But in 1961, he had to step in and direct the end of that film. And he He was less than friendly, at least at that point in his life.
Well, he was. I interviewed one rancher in the area who had worked on a number of films that had been shot there by 1961 when the Comancheros was being made. And he made the comment that he wasn't a very nice person at all, much like the caller's experience indicated. I ascribe that to the pressure that he was under in having to direct what Stuart Whitman told me was half of the Comancheros when Michael Curtiz's cancer condition basically just included him out, as Sam Goldwyn would say, in directing the rest of the picture. And I don't fault someone for reacting that way when he's under that much pressure to save a film in which he has a major stake.
Yeah. About a minute left. Let me ask you about both this question. Scott Eiman, you mentioned in your book that for decades, John Wayne's image was in fashion, and then, of course, it went out of fashion for a time. Where do you figure it is now, these days?
I don't know that he went out of fashion so much as he became passé.
Yeah.
He's never really gone away. Most movie stars are temporal because standards of male beauty – you know, move and shape as much as standards of female beauty. But he was more than a movie star. And he was only beautiful when he was very young. After that, he got attractive in a kind of weathered way. I don't think he's ever gone away. One of the things that I found interesting when I was starting the book is there was this a public opinion poll. I think it was a Gallup poll, asked people their five favorite movie stars. And, I mean, Tom Cruise was there and Denzel Washington was there and a couple other people were there. And John Wayne was there. And at this point, he'd been dead for over 30 years. And I can't think of another movie star that would make a list of five most popular movie stars 30 years after they're dead other than John Wayne. So I don't think he ever really went away. The films have always been in heavy rotation all over cable and broadcast. And frankly, the success of the book, which is in its 10th printing, plug, and on the New York Times bestseller list, plug, much to my surprise, I didn't expect it. The success of the book commercially indicates that he never really went out of style. And I think there's a large portion of the population that still regards him as the American ideal.
Yeah. James Dark, take a couple seconds to say something finally on that.
Well, I think his persona is enjoying a wonderful afterglow of nostalgia. But John Wayne was America, and the image of America changes, but America is something you can't ignore, and you can't ignore John Wayne.
It's James Dark, author of the book When Hollywood Came to Town, A History of Movie Making in Utah, and Scott Eiman, author, of course, of the book, the New York Times best-selling book, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Scott, thanks very much. James, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.